States against Johns. Mr. Stiller.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. On behalf of Christopher Johns, I think the essence of this case is that we had a trial at which the discrete offenses charged in the indictment, the prosecutor's theory of culpability, and the proof never intersected. And as a result, we've got four guilty verdicts that need to be set aside. I'll start with counts 1 through 3, which I, for shorthand purposes, describe as the false statement offenses. As between Arthur and Bobby Tenhoe, husband and wife, as sellers of a house, and Alan Banks, purchaser of a house, evolving negotiations resulted in a scenario in which I refer to note 2 to page 4 of the appellant's reply brief, where Arthur Tenhove acknowledges that prior to performing this agreement in this contract, he understood that on a purchase price of $120,000, he and his wife were to receive no proceeds. Performance, in many regards, defines the existence of an agreement and the terms of the agreement. And the reality is that this somewhat unorthodox agreement involved the Tenhoves selling their house to avoid a foreclosure with the expectation that their first mortgager, their lender, would be fully funded, and that whatever excess money above that $87,000 was going someplace else.
But, you know, the odd thing, you know, I apparently am old-fashioned, but usually when I have signed either first or, you know, home equity line of credit giving somebody an interest in my house, I get money in return for that, so that I can remodel my kitchen or do whatever I'm doing. Whereas embedded in the transaction that you just described is this entirely phony $30,000 second mortgage that both Mr. Tenhoven and the girlfriend, whatever her name was, Ms. Flutterman or something, agree. Neither one of them knew anything about it. It was just fictional. So I think it's that $30,000 of inverse, you know, I mean, just completely dishonest transaction that you need to focus on.
Indeed. That's the gravamen of the action here. While it is certainly unorthodox, on your Honor's terms...
It's not unorthodox. It's phony.
It's not phony, Your Honor.
Yes, it is. He gave an interest in the house for nothing so that he could give away $30,000 for somebody. Don't you see how crazy that is? It's fraudulent.
Let me be transparent.
And it defrauded everyone into failing to realize what the house was really worth. If somebody wants to modify a bankruptcy plan, the way you do it is not by pulling the wool over the eyes of the trustee. You go back to the court and you move to reopen, and perhaps you change the amount of money that is, you know, the creditors can go back and complain. There are all kinds of procedures that people can use in bankruptcy court. Lying to the court, the last I checked, is not one of them.
You've given me a lot, Your Honor. The mortgage was not phony.
But yes, they didn't get any money for it.
They got value for it.
No, they didn't. They didn't get a cent of value for it. It was a $90,000 contract for them, which paid off their $87,000 mortgage.
Foundationally, let me be clear about something. All indications are that my client committed bank fraud. In other words, what the essence of this scheme was for the buyer to receive proceeds from the sale without the buyer's lender being aware of that fact. If true, that's bank fraud, and there's probably accompanying mail and wire frauds flowing from it. The Tenhoves were merely a vehicle for that.
Yeah, well, which of course leads to one of my questions, which is, the only real dispute in this case is whether the right characterization of this fraud is bankruptcy fraud or bank fraud or both. If your client is upset about characterizing it as bankruptcy fraud, how about if we just modify the judgment to call it bank fraud? It's the same penalty.
We'd overlook the presentment clause and findings beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury.
No, you've conceded that your client's committed bank fraud. You just have to strike out the words RUPSI. the letters.
If we overlook the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, that would be perfectly fine. Indeed. But on the indictment that brought my client to a federal court, before whom he appeared in front of a jury and upon which he was found guilty, counts 1 through 3 required that the prosecution prove beyond a reasonable doubt that when my client went to the bankruptcy court to declare the existence of a mortgage, that statement was false. That statement...
On this kind of charge, is bank fraud a lesser included offense of the bankruptcy fraud? Could you have committed the bankruptcy fraud without committing the bank fraud?
As to counts 2 and 3, you could have
committed... It's perfectly normal to substitute one for the other when one is a lesser included offense of the other.
There are different elements, and I want to focus on a distinction between count 1 and counts 2 and 3, with 1 through 3 being different from 4, which we'll address separately. Count 1 required proof of a scheme to defraud, in which a false statement was made to the bankruptcy court.
And you see, I want to say, I mean, I actually am more in overlap land than the thought that these are either or, but it seems to me that the bankruptcy court's job is to administer the bankruptcy estate with full and correct information, and that you want the creditors to be paid, but you also want the debtor to get a fresh start.
Yes.
And when you insert in that process a completely phony document that indicates that $30,000 of value in equity reside in the house that are now going to be disposed of in some other way, that whole process is undermined. It's tainted. The bankruptcy court cannot do its job. Indeed, if they had all that equity in the house, maybe they didn't belong in bankruptcy at all, and maybe the court should have dismissed it, which would have changed their credit history never to have been in bankruptcy. I mean, it's just when you distort the process this way, I don't see how it can operate soundly.
The distortion of the process that Your Honor suggests might be germane to count 4.
And it seems to me it also is germane to whether you are... you're saying that lying to the bankruptcy court isn't fraud on the bankruptcy court.
I'm saying that no lie was told, Your Honor.
Well, and I'm saying that, look, the district court here was entitled to look at this $30,000 thing and decide whether it was, you know, real or Memorex. Is it a real second mortgage, or is it a totally sham document?
First of all, to back up...
I mean, there are sham documents out there in the world. Whether this is one of them is a question.
First of all, I think we've got to back up and examine the essence of the scheme as testified to by the prosecution's cooperating witness. $120,000 was not the value of that home.
Well, we don't know that. You say that, but the jury had evidence before it that the house was sold only a few months later for $125,000. So maybe the Ten Hobes just didn't know what their house was worth.
Their house was worth what someone was normally willing to pay for it.
And a few months after these transactions, apparently some willing buyer out there paid $125,000.
And a few weeks before, the Ten Hoves signed an offer to sell their home for a mere $62,000.
So there's mixed evidence in the record. As long as there's evidence that would support that $120,000 was a possible value, that's about it. I mean, I'm not the jury.
I'm going to pivot at this point.
Okay.
If we want to describe, as Your Honor has, this mortgage is phony and therefore the statement was false, that wasn't for Judge Randa to decide. That was for Christopher John's jury to decide. And during trial, upon the denial of our Rule 29 motion by Judge Randa, pursuant to arguments from the government that what we were proposing was really an issue for the jury, we came back to Judge Randa and we said, okay, if this jury is going to be left to decide the validity of this mortgage, this jury needs to be instructed on Wisconsin law as it relates to contracts and mortgages.
But I found that part of your argument to be I'll just say, quite unpersuasive. It sounded like you wanted to adjourn the jury and pop them into a first-year property and contracts class in law school so that they would be fully informed about the law of property and contracts in Wisconsin. And we don't usually burden juries with that. That's for the judge, and he distills that for the jury, as Judge Randa did.
He didn't distill it for the jury. What Judge Randa did, with all due respect, is he reached the same judicial conclusion that Your Honor is expressing today, that in his mind, this mortgage was phony, and therefore, the jury didn't get to decide whether there was or was not a valid or a phony mortgage with necessary tools. This wasn't the jury's contemplation of what's reasonable or other inference drawing aspects that jurors are always called upon to do. This jury was given no analytical framework with regard to deciding the ultimate question, as to counts 1 through 3, as to whether there was no mortgage such that Christopher John's statement to its existence was false. What this invited is what happened. The face of the mortgage document had immaterial irregularities. The date was problematic, the notary was problematic, and so on and so forth.
And Fletterman was problematic. I mean, you know, it was a phony. I mean, there was no agreement.
Separate and apart from whether there was an agreement, which would be a jury question, there were irregularities. But the instructional deficit allowed a prosecutor to march in front of the jury during the government's rebuttal closing argument saying, look, the date's wrong. This is phony. Well, under Wisconsin law, right date, wrong date, or no date whatsoever has no bearing on the issue of whether or not a mortgage or a contract is or is not phony. The jury had no analytical framework to decide what is really a fairly sophisticated legal area. Turning to count 4, which sort of is an outlier in that it didn't depend on the... I see my white light is on.
That means you're in your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I think I have a sense, given some of your Honor's comments, as to the court's, or at least one judge's, view of count 4. Turning to sentencing, the script got flipped. Whereas everything at trial was about manufacturing equity for the sake of bringing it back to the buyer wrongly, at sentencing, somehow that became the value of homes, and Christopher Johns was held improperly responsible for loss based on value that existed only as a result of the by then proven fraud. So I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Stiller. Mr. Giampietro.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Gordon Giampietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States in this case. I first want to start by responding to some positions in the reply brief, because this is my only opportunity to do so. And there are really two fundamental errors in the reply brief, and they were sort of touched on in the questioning of Mr. Stiller. The first one is, how do you describe the fraud scheme here? From the beginning of this case, Mr. Stiller has insisted that this is a bank fraud case, not a bankruptcy fraud. And the reality is...
And in fact, that's what it looks like to me, at least. Why was this not prosecuted as a bank fraud?
Your Honor, it certainly could have. I think the situation here is we looked at this case as a situation where we had homeowners who were victims.
I was expecting you to answer that it couldn't have been, because the government's theory, the theory on which the penalty rests, is that it was not a bank fraud. Government's theory about the sanction is that $120,000 was the real market value of the home, and that money is being siphoned from the ten hoves to frauders. That's inconsistent with a bank fraud theory. If it was a bank fraud, if this was really a bank fraud case, then there's a problem in computing the guidelines range.
Judge, let me respond to that. I think it depends on how you define the bank fraud. Mr. Banks is a two-time convicted felon at the time. It's not in the record, but the reality is, here's the nature of the bank fraud, Your Honor. It's not that the properties were improperly inflated. The appraisals were false. The bank fraud here is that we are fairly confident that the information provided to the bank regarding his income and his prior criminal history was not made to the bank. That would be the essence of the bank fraud. Not at all that these appraisals were false. So, Judge, that would be the bank fraud that I'm talking about that we could have brought. And I want to be clear about that because we have never taken the position in this case that these were fake appraisals. That has been the defense from the beginning, pre-trial, during trial, and now on appeal. The government has been consistent in this case from the beginning. And I want to point the court back to, in fact, the indictment itself. The allegations in paragraphs 4 and 5 of the indictment are simply this. The essence of the scheme was to fraudulently obtain equity from homes of individuals in financial distress or facing foreclosure. The government did not flip the switch, as Mr. Stiller indicates. We did not have one theory for trial and a different theory for sentencing. We have never taken the position that these were false appraisals. And I stand by that with respect to the evidence we submitted to Judge Rand at sentencing, the comparables, the tax assessment, and the subsequent sales that Your Honor indicated took place. $125,000 just a few, actually 6 months later. And in the case of Michelle Coleman, $16,000 more, the sale that occurred probably 15 months later.
That's actually a different problem. I don't understand how these other transactions get into it. The means by which they might get in is the relevant conduct guideline. But the relevant conduct guideline says you cover everything that's part of the same scheme. The scheme that led to the conviction was bankruptcy fraud. If it's bank fraud, then the scheme might be larger and you can get it in. But this is a bankruptcy fraud scheme, and I gather only one of the four properties whose value was roped in was in bankruptcy.
That's not correct, Your Honor, and here's why. This was, in name, a bankruptcy fraud scheme under 157. It is no different from the mail and wire fraud statutes on which it is patterned. So
I don't care about that.
It no, Judge, this is why
it's in fact a bankruptcy scheme. What you're doing is treating the guidelines as if they were real offense sentencing. And it turns out that our very first opinion interpreting the guidelines back in 1987, soon after they went into force, dealt with the relevant conduct guideline and rejected the very kind of argument you're making in this case.
I disagree, Judge.
Of course, it's not being cited. That was our very first guidelines opinion.
I understand, Judge, and I disagree. The three properties at issue.
You disagree with the law of the Seventh Circuit? That's
Judge,
fine.
I disagree with
it to be overruled.
I disagree with your characterization of the charge in this case. First of all, the three properties that were at issue at trial and at sentencing are pled in the indictment. This is not a situation where we pled the Tenhove property and then brought in at sentencing evidence regarding Michelle Coleman and the Spellers. So I disagree that this is we're in relevant conduct land. First of all, though, it's critically important to understand, while this case is a bankruptcy fraud under 157 and then a series of standalone bankruptcy charges under 152, the 157 charge, which is count one, is indistinguishable from mail and wire fraud. And what I mean by that is, the function of the bankruptcy court is merely the jurisdictional hook on which this, quote, generic fraud scheme gets prosecuted by the federal government. That's why this is not, as you like to say, a bankruptcy fraud scheme. It is a fraud scheme that is in federal court because of the false statement made in the bankruptcy court. So, in essence, it is a fraud on the bankruptcy court, in a way, counts two, three, four, and four. But it is a bankruptcy fraud scheme like the mail fraud and the wire fraud schemes are not frauds on the post office and frauds on AT&T. That is merely the jurisdictional hook whereby this fraud scheme gets charged in federal court. So I disagree with Your Honor that I'm sitting here arguing that the Tenhoves are in a bankruptcy fraud scheme and that Michelle Coleman and the Spellers are some other scheme. It's defined and charged properly. It is a fraud scheme that has as its jurisdictional basis a false statement in bankruptcy. It's no different than the mail wire fraud scheme. And, in fact, if you look at footnote 3 on page 7 of our brief, we cite the cases and we cite Collier's for the proposition that this is indistinguishable from mail and wire fraud. That's why I disagree with Your Honor. So I would say, Judge, again, getting back to Mr. Stiller's point that somehow we have changed our theory of property appraisal. It's not true at all. If you go back and look at the transcript, this citation to Alan Banks' testimony in the reply brief, where he says, well, the idea was to have false appraisals, that's Mr. Stiller's cross-examination of Alan Banks. That may or may not be what Mr. Banks thought he was doing, but from the government's perspective, we have always maintained that these houses had that value and that this was equity stolen from these individual homeowners. And I talked about paragraphs 4 and 5 of the indictment. Paragraph 5, again, I'll read it to the court. As part of the scheme, the defendants would falsely represent to the victim homeowners that they would receive a portion of the equity in the home at the time of closing, but instead the defendants directed all the equity to third parties and to themselves. Nowhere in that indictment is the allegation that there were false appraisals involved. Nowhere at trial did the government introduce evidence that there were false appraisals. There is no evidence in this record whatsoever that these were false appraisals, and I stand by that. And really, interestingly, this is a continuation of Mr. Stiller's argument pretrial. He, in fact, sought dismissal of the indictment based on misjoinder. He asserted the Tenhoes were in bankruptcy, the other victims were not, therefore this is misjoinder. That's incorrect. The judge, Judge Randa, properly rejected that motion. He properly found, based on the cases we cited in footnote 3 of our appellate brief, that this is modeled on the mail and wire fraud statute. And just like all the victims in a mail fraud case don't have to get a mailing, and all the victims in a wire fraud case don't have to get a phone call, that's what this case is about. The other victims did not have to be in bankruptcy. So I disagree. I think we could have charged this case as a bank fraud, not on the basis of the false appraisals, but on the basis of the information we are fairly certain Mr. Banks misled the lenders regarding his income and regarding his past criminal convictions.
Mr. Champagne, do you want to speak to the loss issue in the sentencing context?
Yes. As the court knows, there were two sentencing hearings in this case. It was clear to the government at the first sentencing that Judge Randa did not have sufficient evidence to sort of analyze the question of the true value of these properties. We asked for the adjournment. We collected City of Milwaukee tax assessment records, comparables, and then the sale records that we've put in our short appendix here before the court. And so our view is these properties were worth, in fact, what Mr. Banks offered the various victim homeowners. That is, it's as simple as that. Our view in this case is these victims were offered X for their properties, and one way or the other, they didn't get X. They got X minus $30,000. They got X minus $24,000 in the context of Michelle Coleman. That's always been the theory of this case.
So the, as I understand it, you're saying Mr. Banks' offer was a legitimate offer? That's a market. That's the market price.
Well, I would say this from the perspective.
So he's part of the fraud.
Well, I would say this, right? We know that in this time frame, right, the market was going crazy. Everybody was benefiting, probably in some sense, you know, an inflated marketplace. Nonetheless, why does Mr. Banks get to enjoy the profits of that inflated marketplace a few months later, but the Tenhodes and Michelle Coleman do not? So my question is, vis-a-vis the victim homeowners, they're offered a certain amount of money, their expectation is they're going to get that money. And so in a perfect world or in a normal marketplace, the market value is what's offered, right? That is the market value. It's what is offered. They were offered X. They didn't get X. That's the essence of the fraud scheme here. Does that answer your question, Judge, on the loss issue?
Well, I'm not
entirely.
I'm not quite there yet, Mr. Okay. I think this case.
No, I mean, if one applies that rationale, then in any of these mortgage flipping schemes, which are clear bank frauds, they wouldn't actually be bank fraud, because on that rationale, since the fraud feeser offered this price, that was the market price, right, although they were paying with the bank's money.
No, I disagree, Judge.
It's siphoned off.
But, Judge, I disagree. You have to look.
It's not only inconsistent with what we've held, it would be an insane position for a criminal prosecutor to take.
Judge, I disagree strongly. There are certainly bank fraud cases that involve fake appraisals, and the property flipping cases that you're talking about are exactly that. That is not this case. There is nothing in this record that these appraisals were false in any way. That is not the theory of this prosecution at all.
And so you're relying on, for example, the City of Milwaukee's assessment records that you put back here in your
brief? In the short appendix, Your Honor, yes.
In the short appendix.
Yes.
I was looking at some of those. So I'm not going to find it offhand, but like in 2007 for one of the properties, this is page 7. 2007, the total was $126,000. It goes up to $136,000. That's the assessment history.
Right. The next page, Judge, for that particular property, I believe, is Michelle Coleman's property, and that's going to be the sales information. So if you look on, I believe
right,
it's short appendix page 8.
Yep.
You'll see the sale from Michelle Coleman to Mr. Banks is $134,000.
Right, and then 150.
And then 150.
So you have that evidence, and then you have the later transaction to get away from the false appraisal inference.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. I totally agree that in a different traditional property flipping scheme where the evidence is in the record of a false appraisal, that's the theory that the government is going on in terms of the bank fraud. When I answered Judge Easterbrook's question earlier about I could have charged this case as a bank fraud, I meant in the context of the false statements Mr. Banks put on the applications regarding his income and regarding the fact that he had two prior felony convictions. So I don't want to confuse those issues. It's not the bank fraud that the court was thinking of. It's a different bank fraud. If there are no more questions, I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Stiller?
Yes, please, with regard to sentencing. I'll start with certain of Judge Easterbrook's questions regarding relevant conduct. While the jurisprudence certainly likens a Section 157 bankruptcy fraud prosecution to mail and wire fraud prosecution, there's validity to that, but only to a point. Whereas a wire and a mail fraud simply involve a scheme that occasions somebody's use of the mail or the wire lawfully or otherwise, 157, as charged in this case, required not only the scheme to defraud and some connection to bankruptcy, but the false statement being made to the bankruptcy court. So in other words, in terms of what this scheme was, it was a scheme to defraud plus affirmative malfeasance directed towards the bankruptcy court, which is different from mail and wire fraud. Judge Flom, turning to your question about the loss issue. The reality is that Judge Randa never valued these properties. Instead, what he somehow did, and his remarks are somewhat difficult to synthesize, he decided that the Tenhoves and the Colemans had no equity, so there was no actual loss. But he found that Banks and Johns gained from the transaction. And he incorrectly labeled Banks and John's gain as being intended loss. The guideline commentary doesn't allow gain to become intended loss, especially whereas in connection with both the Tenhove transaction and the Coleman transaction, Banks meant to and did in fact make good on his loans once he rehabilitated and resold the properties. So given the tenor of the court's questions this morning, I think this now does boil down to a sentencing question. I'm not conceding the culpability questions, but I think clearly we've got to go back for a resentencing on more precise loss calculations. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.